And I think we're in the midst of a real sea change when we think about sustainability, because for many years, sustainability has been about doing less harm, emitting less CO2, wasting less water, ensuring less waste goes to the landfill. And those strategies and tactics around sustainability have not adequately addressed the challenges that we're facing in the world, both environmentally, but socially as well. And it's dangerous to separate the social dimension out of the notion of sustainability and just focus on the environment, because we can't have a healthy environment when we're not paying people a living wage. I don't think the U.S. government should be subsidizing the payroll costs of business. Business should be paying a wage that people can live on.
Welcome to Mindful Businesses, presented by Sarani, and I'm your host, Vidya Iyer. In our podcast, we bring to you brands which are mindful in their practices and processes. A mindful business adopts and employs sustainable social, economic, and environmental practices. Today, we have with us Jeffrey Hollander, CEO of American Sustainable Business Council, and in my opinion, the father of the sustainable consumer goods and thought movement in America. He is the co-founder of Seventh Generation. It is a privilege to have you on Mindful Businesses. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you. Happy to be here with you.
You co-founded Seventh Generation in 1988. That's about 33 years ago. The sustainable goods industry was at its nascency. Most people didn't even think about recycling or green practices in their everyday life. Did most municipalities even have curbside recycling then?
Generally speaking, not. I mean, we were quite far ahead of the curve, which sometimes is a blessing and sometimes is a curse. If you're that far ahead of the curse, you better be good at surviving, because it took our culture and our society many years, and in some respects, they're still catching up with the idea that the choices that we make in the products that we purchase and use can have a huge impact on society and the planet.
How did you think about these things? Because it wasn't the norm. What influenced you to think about these practices, about being green, about being sustainable?
So back in 1985, I wrote a book called How to Make the World a Better Place, A Beginner's Guide. And that book was my exploration of all the things we could do as individuals to make a contribution to solving the challenges that our planet faces. And in writing that book, it became clear to me that business had an important role to play in addressing the challenges we were facing. And of all the businesses that I could think of, the environment was an area where business could make perhaps the biggest contribution. So the idea was quite simple: sell products that lessen your negative footprint, imprint on the planet, water conservation, energy conservation, and other products that mitigated the negative impact that most of us have on the planet. And that was an idea that appealed mostly to members of environmental organizations. It was not an idea that appealed to the public widely till probably a decade or so later.
And how old were you when you wrote that book?
I think I was about 31. I had just sold my first business to Warner Communications. It was a publishing company, and I took some time off after the business was sold to sort of figure out what I was going to do next in my life. And writing the book was my way of figuring that out.
You did not graduate from college.
I did not. I went to Hampshire College for a year and a half, but then I took a year off and never went back. And again, not that I'm not a huge advocate of education, I just didn't like being a full-time student. Every business that I've been involved with subsequent to dropping out of college has been very educationally focused. Much of what Seventh Generation had to do was to educate people on the connection between their behavior and product choices in the planet. So education has featured prominently in all the businesses that I've started. And in fact, the first business I started was a continuing education program.
So my father was an entrepreneur his whole life. He felt that education, though it opened your mind, often also held you back. he would call it the handicap of a learned man or woman. So do you think it made you more maverick? It did not restrain you. You were a creative, smart person, not going to college, not being constrained by people's thought. You could create your own thoughts.
Well, I think there were two positive things about not going to college. I mean, one, in terms of my business career, I got a head start of almost 6 years on people that go to college and then go get an MBA. So I had already had a lot of firsthand business experience by the time they graduated from their MBA programs. Mm-hmm. But secondly, I learned something that was really important, which was there's almost nothing you can't teach yourself or find some very bright person to help you learn. And that process of educating myself on issues that are new to me and finding mentors to help teach me about those things was really a powerful experience, because by choosing my mentors rather than depending upon the teacher that was assigned to the class I enrolled for, I could choose some really wonderful people. And I had the incredible, unique luck to study with people like Marshall McLuhan, to study with people like incredible educational philosopher Ivan Illich, who wrote Deschooling Society, and a number of other wonderful, wonderful mentors. And in some ways, you know, that's how I got my education.
So how hard was it to go against the grain and how to even educate the consumer? One of your products early on was
Low flow showerhead.
So how hard was it at that time to go completely against the grain? Now we know terminologies like green initiatives or sustainable initiatives. At that point in time, people didn't even use these words in everyday business or everyday life.
It was certainly a challenge. I mean, I think we were able to make a good argument that a low flow showerhead not only helps save fresh water, which is a resource that we're running out of, but low-flow showerheads actually reduced your consumption of hot water, which allowed you to actually save money every time you took a shower. And we would present the customer with both the environmental and the financial argument for the use of the product. And it's really interesting because over 30 years later, those low-flow showerheads are mandated in most hotel rooms and public showers. So again, we were ahead of our time, but we're definitely on to something that is a really important tool in fighting climate change, as well as the limited amount of fresh water that we have available to us.
And sustainability for any brand is a journey. You know, we evolve, right? There's no absolute.
No, we're all on a spectrum of great to horrible, and we're somewhere in between. And I think we're in the midst of a real sea change when we think about sustainability, because for many years, sustainability has been about doing less harm, mm-hmm. emitting less CO2, wasting less water, ensuring less waste goes to the landfill. And those strategies and tactics around sustainability have not adequately addressed the challenges that we're facing in the world, both environmentally, but socially as well. And today, I think we have to move towards an approach that is either called net positive or regenerative, where we can't be focused on not doing harm and not doing something bad. We actually have to focus on fixing the challenges that we're facing. Mm-hmm. We have to focus on regenerating the soil by using regenerative agriculture practices that build up the quality of the soil, that sequester CO2 in the soil. And agriculture is a wonderful place to practice these regenerative tactics, because businesses selling products that come from agriculture can play a very important role in their supply chain by helping the source that they're working with move in a more responsible direction.
Sustainability is not only environment. It requires that we pay fair wages, we pay benefits, time off, maternity leave, and job security. What was the culture at Seventh Generation?
You know, in many ways, many companies like to market what's good about them, and it looks better from the outside than it does from the inside. Our goal was to sort of flip that around and share some of the good things we were doing with our customers and our stakeholders, but really work hard to do things like create the best working experience that anyone has ever had, to make sure that all employees are an ownership stake in the business and can participate with our shareholders in the value that they create. So that social context is really critical. We face huge challenges in this country from a social perspective, tremendous income inequality, and one of the great ways we can address income inequality is by making sure employees are owners, making sure that we have more cooperatively owned businesses and more businesses that are owned by their workers, whether they're an ESOP, a co-op, or another structure that allows that to happen. But that's really important, and it's dangerous to separate the social dimension out of the notion of sustainability and just focus on the environment, because we can't have a healthy environment when we're not paying people a living wage. People can't be expected to be focused on and concerned about the environment when they can't feed their families. So we have to ensure that the well-being of people and our own employees and workers is taken care of at the same time as we're addressing the environmental challenges we face.
So you had nap rooms in Seventh Generation before Google did.
We had nap rooms built into the first office that we ever had. And that was the innovation of my co-founder, Alan Newman. I was probably a little too much of an uptight New York business person to go for the nap rooms, but he insisted on that. We also had no chairs in any of our conference rooms. Everyone came and sat on the floor. There was no conference table. There were no chairs. We had a lot of practices. In our monthly staff meeting, we would give out an award to the person that made the biggest mistake in the past month, to try to encourage people to be open and share the mistakes they made so that they don't get repeated and we can learn from them. So we had an unusual culture, but it was a culture that was aligned with our values and our mission as a company.
True. So you were mindful on all levels, not just marketing products, which are environmentally friendly.
You might say we were a green company, not a company that sold green products.
Talking about products and talking about sustainability, there is this dichotomy as an entrepreneur, a sustainable entrepreneur, and you're constantly creating products. You are creating the waste. You're creating things which are causing harm in the long term. How does an entrepreneur cope with this conflicting values, conflicting missions to make profit, to make products, and like you said, to have a positive impact on the planet?
Yeah, I mean, part of the challenge we face is that business is based upon pushing off negative externalities onto society. And the rules and regulations and incentives that govern business, the way they report their finances, are all driven around, in some ways, maximizing those externalities. And we really have to change the rules by which business gets done if we want better outcomes, if we want more sustainable, responsible businesses. We have to stop incentivizing them to externalize their negative impacts. And we need to do that through more involvement in public policy. For the past 30 or 40 years, business public policy has really been driven by a handful of huge multinational corporations. And that has not been a good influence. And what the American Sustainable Business Council tries to do is bring together responsible companies like Seventh Generation and Ben & Jerry's and Patagonia to advocate for public policies that basically make companies pay the price for those externalized costs so that they're financially incentivized to not do that. Right now, it's hard to convince companies to do something that's good for the environment, but bad for their bottom line. You know, we have to change the structure of that regulatory environment. I mean, the U.S. government spends over $1 billion a year subsidizing the virgin timber industry. That artificially increases the price of toilet paper made from recycled fiber because they're not getting those subsidies. We subsidize fossil fuel industry.